S.
Lucky's going to help me out here. Everybody, I'm an addict named Donnie. I'm real glad to be, well, I'm not real glad to be here, but I'm here. And I want to thank Central Maryland for doing a great job here. That speaker last night was tremendous. And all the people have done a lot of hard work around here, and they've made another great convention. And it's just been a really good time down here. Don't pick up, you won't get high. It's pretty simple. That's pretty much all the whole program is, if we don't get high. And that's a problem, just not picking up. Problem for us anyway. I think the Surgeon General once said that if you wear your seatbelt, stop smoking, and eat sensibly, you'll live a long and happy life. But I don't think he was talking to us. You're talking to somebody other than us, because we got to do a little something more than that, and that's not pick up. I came down here Thursday, and you know, usually I sign up for the when you fill out your registration form, you check off the stuff you want to do, help out or something. And I always check off, you know, whatever you need, just call me. And no one ever calls. And Central Maryland, man, the phone's been ringing and ringing and ringing. I got to go here and I got to go there. And so the first one I did, I went to merchandising, and I thought sure that when I got there, they'd assign me a crew and they'd be an area and I could organize it and make it all just right. And I walked in there and I said, well, I'm here. What should I do? And they said, well, there's a pile of T-shirts over there. Why don't you just go fold those T-shirts? So we folded about 10 boxes of T-shirts. So every T-shirt up there folded, I had my hands on. So, and I wasn't... So they didn't let me run anything, and they didn't let me organize anything, and they didn't let me merchandise, and they didn't let me test out my sales skills on you guys. I think you guys know the tricks anyway for sales. I had a birthday about 12 days ago, and it's just another birthday. I turned 55. It's not a particular milestone, but I got tons and tons of calls. I got emails. I got... text messages, I got cards from a whole bunch of people who told me that they loved me. And they told me that they were glad I was in their life. And they said that they were happy that I was around. And about 7-8 years ago, I didn't get any of those calls at all. Nobody called. Nobody cared. And for a lot of the birthdays before that, I never really showed up. I'd be out 3 or 4 days. And it was another event that I could go use over. Birthday or any day, you know. And it was just really cool. And I was kind of touched a little more this year than I am most years, because every year I get some more friends. I get more people in my life, and I get to meet a new person, and he's a part of my network now. And there's somebody out there using right now that'll be a part of my network next year. And hopefully he'll be here and folding T-shirts and, you know, doing something around here and staying clean, just not picking up. And that's been the case for me. Every year I meet more people, and it's really cool. Every year for my birthday, my mom sends me a check, and it's for, I got a check from mom for $55 this year because I'm 55 years old. And every year she gives me another check, and it's kind of like I look forward to it. You know, $55 meant a lot a few years back, but right now, you know, it's just kind of love that's coming through with the card and all. And at Christmas, I send her my medallion and my key tag. And this year I sent her a 7-year medallion, and I can send her a lot of presents if I want to, but that's the one she wants the most. So I don't get to pass my medallion off to you know, maybe a sponsee or a new guy like some of you guys get to do, but I have to send it to mom, because if I don't, it's going to be trouble. And all the things that I do throughout the year to earn that medallion are things that I need to do every year so that I can give my mom an 8-year medallion next year. And just by doing those things, a lot of good things have happened for me. You know, this is just not picking up is one of the hardest things that I ever had to do. A lot of people, I hear people sharing in meetings, and they start at different places, And sometimes if I'm speaking at a rehab or something, I'll hit them with the paranoia and the, you know, going for 4 or 5 days and no shower and no brush your teeth and checking into places and checking out with the same clothes on and all of that stuff. And sometimes I'll talk to people and say, you know, the lowest point in my life was when I was sitting in the parking lot at Avery Road Treatment Center at 45 years old and wondered, how did I get here, you know? And then sometimes I'll see a new guy at a meeting and just give him a hug and say, you know what, I know you're scared. I know you're terrified right now. And I know you don't know what to do. Let me help you, you know? And sometimes that's just what keeps me clean. And I do those things, and that's what helps me. There's my friend Kurt sent me a story about a kid named Kyle. He was in junior high school, and he was leaving school on a Friday. He had his arms full of books and all his stuff from his locker, and he was walking out of the school, and the bully boys came up to him, and they knocked his books down, knocked him down, and called him a nerd and a freak. And he was just at his lowest point, and this other guy was happened to be watching, and he came over and helped him out a little bit. He helped him pick up his books, and he walked home with him. It turns out they lived a couple of doors down from each other. They became best of friends. They, you know, they went on to high school together, went to college together, and they had families. And Kyle had done so well that he gave the speech at his doctorate when he graduated. And he told a story about that day in junior high. The lowest point in his life, somebody had come up to him and helped him out. But what his friend didn't know, that he was on his way home to kill himself. And he wanted to clean his locker out so his mom and dad wouldn't have to do it. And his friend never knew that. So, you know, we do that every day here. When we see people at their lowest point in their whole life, we go and we give them a hand and we give them a hug and we say, can I help you? We say, can I just, you know, sit with you? I'm going to a meeting tomorrow. If you want a friendly face to sit with, I'll be there. We do all those things. We help out. We just be there for other people. And if it weren't for other people, I wouldn't be here. I know I wouldn't be here. If it wasn't for the people in this program, I would never have stayed. You know, I was at a point in my life where I didn't care. I was like Kyle. If the next hit took me out, well, you know, supposed to take me out, I guess. I just didn't know that the joy that I could have in my life was as much as it is today. You know, I have so many friends in my life. You know, I have quality friends now. I had these Nationals tickets a couple of years ago, and I was trying to find somebody to go to the game with me. And my girlfriend, we go to a lot of games together, and we have a great time, and it's like a date night out, and we have fun, and it's a kind of little social thing, and we go and we root on the home team a little bit, and we people watch a little bit, and we just kind of hang out. It's just kind of fun to do that. And she was down in Florida picking up an award for her work. She had excelled in what she does, and she was getting an award for that. And so I said, well, maybe I'll call my friend Mark. And, well, he was in New York picking up an award for something good he did. I said, I'll call my friend Mike G. He don't really like baseball, but he likes hanging out. And he through the gift of recovery, was up at Black Fly Lake in Canada spending time with his parents that he would never have been able to do if he had gotten high. I'll try to call my friend Robert. He was coordinating a family reunion, thousands of dollars at stake, and you know, when I met him, he was on a $5 a day budget from his wife. His wife had him on lockdown with money. and he was doing that, all gifts of recovery. All these things are just because we don't pick up and we don't get high. All these things, you know. And I went through a few more people, and you know, they're all doing this and they're doing that. I can't go. I'm with service. I got to go to the jail. I got to go here. I got to go there. So I just left the tickets in the drawer and I went to a meeting. And when I got to the meeting, there were three new guys there. And I got to spend a couple minutes with those new guys talking to them. You know, I'm a guy that was sitting in the parking lot at Avery Road with my head in my hands saying, how did I get here? And now I get a chance I have some experience. And I somehow I've found some strength through you guys. And I have some hope. I hear stories from you guys all the time about hope. And you know, if I don't pick up and I don't get high, I can use that experience and continue not picking up. You know, I listen to people sharing meetings well, let me back up a little bit. My home group's Illness and Recovery, And once a month, we read the informational pamphlets. And they're great things because they're real short, and I don't have to remember anything. You know, I start reading It Works, How, and Why, and I get 2-3 pages into it. And I said, what was in the first page? My attention span isn't that long anymore. So these are great. They're short. They're concise. It's like one thought pattern in here. And this is a recovering relapse one, and in the bottom of it, it talks about the bugaboos that used to haunt us. I love saying that word, bugaboos, you know. Anybody know what bugaboos are? Huh? They're a steakhouse up on Shady Grove Road, yeah. I know that. There's a bank in Canada called a bugaboo bank. I don't know where that came from. But Wikipedia says a bugaboo is something that worries us or brings fear into our life. And that's what a bugaboo is. And when I came in here, I had a whole bunch of bugaboos. And for some reason, after I decided to stay, and it took a couple of years for me to stay, I got a whole pile of white chips at home. And for some reason, I stayed. And for some reason, you guys didn't say, well, you're right, Donnie, this isn't going to work for you, so you don't have to come back anymore. Instead, you just hugged me, told me to keep coming back. I kept coming back, and I kept getting the courage somewhere to pick up another white chip and another white chip. I didn't pick up all of them I was supposed to, but I picked up enough of them to get to pass, you know, to get by. And, you know, as I did that, I listened to people talk, and I'm not a big talker anyway, so I it was easy for me to sit and listen. And I listened to people talk about getting through deaths in their family. That's a bugaboo for some people. Getting through deaths of pets in their family, that's a bugaboo for some people. You know, am I going to use if this happens to me? Well, when you're new, you think those things, you know? Am I going to use if I hit the lottery? Well, I don't know, maybe. You know, I get a big rock in the island somewhere and I say goodbye to you guys, you know? Maybe. Am I going to use if I know I'm going to die? You know, those are the bugaboos that haunt us. And as I listen to people talk and listen to people tell me about their bugaboos and how they got through that stuff and how they made it to where they are today and how their life is okay even though the stuff happens to them, you know, losing kids, gaining kids. You know, a lot of people in our fellowship's getting kind of, when I first came around, I didn't hear a lot of people talking about their moms and dads having Alzheimer's and dying and all that, taking care of our parents the way that a lot of us do now. And, you know, when my turn comes, thanks to you guys, I hope I'll be ready to do that too. My mom and dad have been, I'm not a guy that came from an abused childhood. My mom and dad were wonderful to me. They taught me right from wrong. They taught me a good work ethic. They taught me how to treat people. My memories of childhood were sitting around a dining room table at night having dinner. Macaroni and cheese with hot dogs in it sometimes or burned up steak or something, but it was always together. We talked about what was going on with us. And you know, I come from I found out through doing some step work that I've come from a long line of making bad decisions. And I can remember, you know, my dad taking me aside when I just barely graduated from high school. I went to Western High School in Northwest Washington. It's Duke Ellington now. But I graduated in 71 by the skin of my teeth because I didn't really want to go to school anymore. And I found some guys that like doing some other stuff rather than go to school. Also, I got a bad picking peer people, you know, people to show me the way. I always go with make the wrong decision there until the last 7 years, of course. But, you know, once I graduated from high school, my parents took me aside and they said, well, do you think you want to go to college? And I said, well, you know, I think I'm good right now. I don't think I want to do that. See, I had this good job at Johnny's Golf down in Georgetown driving a tow truck and pumping gas, and I was making $2.75 an hour, and I had money in my pocket, and I could go up to Good Guys and Clancy's and those places at night. I could hang out, and I could do what I wanted to do, and life was good. Life was simple. Life was easy. And so my parents said, well, there's no sense in us doing that if you don't want to do it. So I said, good, sounds good to me, you know. So we were cool there for a little while, but Dad wasn't going to let that go. And then we had another little talk, a little walk around the house. And he said, and remember, this is 1971. He said, these new things coming out, they're called computers. And somebody's got to fix those computers. What do you think about that? I said, that'll never take on. I don't really want to get involved with computers, you know. That'll never happen. So now there's two bad decisions I made, you know, in a row. And of course, he didn't let that go either. And he talked to some of his friends. He was already networking way before I ever heard of networking. And he got me hooked up with a friend of his that was a foreman at a plumbing company. And I started at the bottom rung there and worked my way up to what I'm doing now. And that's been real good, but the bad decisions continued, you know. I went to work for a plumbing supply company, and there was a guy that worked there. His father was a chemist at Upjohn. And he said, man, this is like in the 80s or something, early 80s. He said, man, we're coming out with this new product, man. Just mortgage the house, everything, and put your money in this thing. I said, man, I ain't doing that. It was Rogaine. So if I had done that, I'd have been on that island with that big rock probably right now. I'd probably be dead, man, if I had made that good decision. But I didn't make that good decision once again. I'd have been set, but that didn't happen either. And you know, where I am today is where I'm supposed to be today, and it's right here. And I can't believe I go from a guy that didn't know anything, didn't know what to do with his life, to being here with you guys. And it's been a great journey. It's been ups and downs. It hadn't happened fast enough a lot of times. But you know, it's just a real, real simple thing. If I don't pick up, I won't get high. And if I don't get high, the sky's the limit for me. You know, it really is. And I can do anything I want to in here. You know, I'm so proud of the people that are in my life. And, you know, my girlfriend's going back to school, and I'm real proud of her for that. We have a great relationship. And, you know, that's the only reason that's happening is because of step work and learning how to treat one another, you know. And I got other people in my life. They're getting promoted, they're getting new jobs, they're changing careers, they're buying houses, they have stuff, and every time they do that, they get to be better people. And what happens is I get to end up hanging around with better people. Every time they get better, here I am getting a little better too. And the peer people that I was talking about before that led me down all these convoluted paths in my life and ended up getting me in trouble, my decision to follow them, and it's my deal that I did that. You know, those aren't the people I hang around with anymore. I hang around with you guys. And I got to go to work every day just like you guys, and I got to put up with the people at work who aren't working the program every day like you guys. But every night I get to come to a meeting, or every day I'm having a bad day, I can say, well, at least I get to go to a meeting tonight and get an hour of solitude. And if I'm having a great day, I said, you know what, I got some dessert coming to me today. I get to go to a meeting tonight and hang out with my friends, you know. And it's really a cool thing. And I really, really, why me, you know, why us? So many people are dead. I got this white key tag that I hang up in my rearview mirror of my work truck. And it's not the first one, it's not the last one. It's hooked to my wristband from the treatment center. And the date on it's August 19th, 1999. I keep having to write it in because it keeps fading. You know, the memory of the treatment center keeps fading, so I had to keep writing back on it so I remember. And the white key tag's got a couple of, it's got four guys' names on it, and they're all dead. They died of this disease. And I thought, you know, those four guys would keep their memory alive, but, you know, the people are dying all the time around us. Our friends are dying. I have sponsees that are just gung-ho for a minute, and then you don't see them anymore. You don't hear from them anymore. All we can do is share the message. We can say where we came from and how we got here. And all we can do is be here for them when they come back and hope they come back, you know. I worry about a few people right now. We were talking last night and, you know, all I can do is be here for people. And hopefully they come back and hopefully they're going to be okay. I just want to read one thing and then I'm kind of done. And sometimes that the gratitude I feel for getting my life back is overwhelming. I just want to share this with everyone. But no amount of therapy and drugs can relieve me of the sins of my past. Oh, forgiveness. Thanks for letting me share.
My name is Sharon, and I'm an addict. Hey, and I want to thank Donnie for sharing very nicely with us his experience, strength, and hope. Our second speaker is Jim R. All right.
Love you back. I'm an acronym, Jim. And it's a good day to be clean. And it's a good day not only to be in a meeting, but to be in a convention of Narcotics Anonymous here in Ocean City. And I'm part of the Central Maryland area that's putting this convention on. And I, too, would like to say thank you to all the people in Central Maryland that busted their ass over the past year to make this thing what it is. They really did an awful lot of work. I came in on the tail end, like here at the convention, to help out. But people in Central Maryland really, really did a lot of work to put this thing on. So let's give them a hand. So the topic is, if you don't pick it up, you can't get high. That's it. I'm done. It's that simple. And if it was that simple, we wouldn't need Narcotics Anonymous. We wouldn't need this program that was given to us by God for people like us. You know, when I got here, I thought I was like terminally unique. You didn't have the problems I had. You hadn't been through the things I'd been through. You certainly didn't have the screwed up childhood I did. And I was a better than addict when I got here. And, you know, a lot of people share about they were sent here by the courts, or the parole officer sent them here. They were just so beaten up that they just finally dragged their ass into a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous. And you know, basically I got to NA because the Maryland Board of Nursing felt that I was a menace to patient safety. And they were right. You know, it's part of my story, and when I first came around, I didn't share it that much in the rooms because I was afraid, because, like, the statute of limitations weren't up yet. But, like, I've got some clean time now, and the statute of limitations are gone for the shit that I did. And, you know, you said your birthday was 12 days ago. What day?
The 31st.
I'm also born on March 31st.
Wow.
So, it's nice to see somebody that turned older than me on that day, though. I turned 48. And the cool thing is next Friday, God willing, the creek don't rise, and I keep doing what I've been doing for the past 9 years, I will have 9 years clean. And you're looking at a guy that couldn't put a day clean, could not stop, just couldn't. You know, when I was 8 years old, somebody said, give the boy a beer, it won't hurt him. Here I am. The basement was full of booze. My parents didn't go to the liquor store, they delivered. And it was a mess. I grew up in a very dysfunctional alcoholic family. And when I got here, I blamed them for everything. I blame my friends for everything. It was everybody else's fault. Through this program, through step work, through having a sponsor, I've come to find out that they just did the best of what they had. I found peace with that. And it let me continue in my process here. Because if you don't deal with the shit you come in here with, it will deal with you. There is no doubt. Now, you know, once again, if you don't pick it up, you can't get high. Again, it sounds so simple. And yet, there are certain things that you have to do here to make that statement happen. And again, when I got here, I didn't want to hear any of it. I was sent here. I had to come here for 3 years. Let's see, the board of nursing said I had to go to 4 meetings. The place I went to rehab at, I was having to send slips back for 7 meetings a week. Employee assistance was watching my ass, and so was my job. You know, I would sneeze at work, and they go, he's using. I would have an emotion at work, and they'd go, he's high. Because they had not seen me with emotions. all they saw was like, I just come in truck. I was the ever dependable, like, you know, nurse at work, Johnny on the spot. More than happy to give your patient their pain medications. Yeah, you know, in the beginning they got some. One for you, one for me. One for you, two for me. Two Tylenols for you, and I'm running with the pills. And I'll tell you, I felt like a piece of shit for doing that to people. And when I came here, I was wrapped up in the shame and guilt of that, and really the shame and guilt of my whole life. I ripped and ran for 31 years. There was a time in my life when I finally decided that alcohol was my problem. So I white-knuckled it. I stopped drinking. I almost blew my head off because I was going through DTs. And if I knew then what I know now, I certainly would have gone into a hospital because alcohol withdrawal or withdrawal from like benzos like Valium and all that shit can kill you. It can kill you. You may want to die coming off of opiates, but it's not going to kill you. And so through a real convoluted process, these guys that I met just, you know, it was a coincidence, right? God had nothing to do with it. I met these guys, and they started dragging me to meetings in the other fellowship. And this was 1990, and basically they told me, sit down, shut the hell up, don't say a damn thing, and you need to listen. And if anybody wants to talk to you, they'll do it after the meeting. And that's when you can talk. And basically all I heard when they read the readings or when anybody else shared was like that adult voice from Charlie Brown cartoons. Wah, 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 wah. Because I really felt that, you know, I had gone 2 months before I found them and I had stopped drinking and, you know, I was okay. I had sort of done this thing on myself, and I went around them for about a year, and then I moved, and I was pretty well cured. Alcohol was my problem. I knew how to do drugs. And, you know, it wasn't anything where I didn't have a habit yet. But if I got a prescription, it was gone. It was gone. 1 to 2 every 3 to 4 means 3 to 4 every 1 to 2. And then on certain days, you could just double that, but because, you know, that's what I needed. They just didn't know any better. And but it got to a point, I had an incident happen working in an emergency room where I got picked up and thrown off a wall 3 times by a patient, and I ended up with 2 herniated discs in my back. And after that, all I had to do in that hospital was stand up and go, and like prescription pads were flying. People write me scripts, here you go, da-da-da, what you need. And, you know, I ended up in one of these pain clinics and it was gone. It was off. I was like, that was it. And I was popping more pills than I knew what to do with. And they were giving me more than I knew what to do with for a while. But I certainly found out what to do with them. And, you know, it went from there. It progressed. And I kept picking it up. I kept getting high. And I knew in the back of my head there was that one little, like, soft voice going, you're in trouble. This is getting out of control. And the other 32 voices in my head were going, shut up. We don't want to hear from you. Because we've got them again. Because, like, you know, at the end of that alcohol thing, the handle on that bottle was so I didn't have to use a glass. And I would drink one of those every night. And so I used drugs the same way that I drank. Always used it all. Even when I was an adolescent coming up, like, guys that I went to high school with that are dead now because of this disease were telling me, you need to slow down. You got a problem. And I said, my problem was I just couldn't get enough. So, you know, sort of fast forward, I got home from work one night, and I was emptying out my pockets, which I always did, and there were two pills in my hand. I'm like, oh my God, I didn't give these to that patient. I need to take these back. And the next thing that came out of my brain was, I need to take these. And I realized it was that easy. And it just, you know. And it took me to a point where I knew I was horribly addicted. I had a horrible problem. I had overdosed a couple times at home to where, like, you know, I wake up and the dog is licking my face going, you okay? You better get up and get that spike out of your arm because she's going to find you again. Again. And about a month and a half, 2 months before my 39th birthday, I was praying to a God that I did not believe existed. Just help me. The last addict prayer. Not get me out of this one and I won't do it again. You know, don't. Whenever the phone rang, it was them. They had finally figured it out and they were calling me. I just knew it was them. I wouldn't answer the damn phone. I was helpless, I was hopeless, and I was suicidal. I had a telephone pole picked out on Old Gunpowder Road. And if I could have figured out how to get an airbag out of a truck, I most likely would not be talking to you today. But I just knew that if I put that truck into that telephone pole with an airbag in it, I would end up as a quadriplegic with some nurse taking care of me that would probably be stealing all my damn drugs. There was also a lot of other unmanageability in my life. Something else I kept picking up and kept getting high off of was a relationship with a girlfriend. And that wasn't too good for my relationship with my wife. But you see, I rationalized it in my mind that I had stopped sleeping with my wife, so I really wasn't cheating on her when I was sleeping with my girlfriend. We can rationalize and justify the most outrageous nonsense. My life was an absolute mess. It was falling apart around me. On my 39th birthday, on March 31st, I was finally intervened on by what I know now was my higher power. At that time, it was the director of nursing for the facility I worked at. That left a message for me that said, you need to report to my office. And I knew right then that they had finally caught up with me. She sat me down and was very nice and asked me if I had a problem. And I lied my ass off. I said, how dare you accuse me of something like that? Don't you know who I am? She said, okay, well, you can't come back to work until you go pee for employee assistance. And I knew right then that I had to find out some way to beat that piss test. And, you know, I went through the whole thing of trying to rig up this whole big way to do it. And at the time, asked my wife, finally told her what was going on. She punched me right in the forehead. And she was in the Army. And then I asked her to give me a clean urine sample, and she did. And I was going to use that up until that very last moment that day. And I tried. Well, I didn't use for like 3 days, and God, I was sick. I was so sick. And I finally decided that morning, just go pee. See what happens. Maybe you'll be okay. And I went in and I talked to the lady at EAP and I laid out my little sob story to her about injuring my back, and I had these prescriptions, and, you know, and I really had a legal reason to use is what I was telling myself. And she just sat there, and she's very prim and proper, like real light-skinned African-American lady, and she's... And I'm thinking, I've got this lady snowed, man. She has not a clue. I got her in the palm of my hand. And when I got done, she just handed me a cup and said, okay, well, just go pee in this. And you can use the public restroom. I was like, oh, my God. I could have beat this thing a whole bunch of times. But God was already intervening. God was giving me willingness that I did not have, did not know, didn't want. When that test came back, the medical reporting officer for the lab called that lady at EAP and said, where did you get this sample from? And she said, from one of our nurses. And he said, bullshit. I have only seen levels like this in autopsies. I used to brag about that when I came around here. I thought that was some real hot shit. Today it scares me to death. Because if I pick it up, I'm gone. And you know what? We tell everybody around here, keep coming back. I don't know if I can walk back through the doors. I really don't. I knew I was going to lose my job, lose my insurance, everything. And I went back in and I sat down in front of that lady and I just cried. And I told her, I said, I know I'm out of here, but just point me in the right direction. And she's sitting there all prim and proper and she just smiled at me and she said, well, she goes, we're not going to fire you. God moment. God intervening. We're going to send you to treatment. And we're going to report you to the Maryland Board of Nursing. In fact, you're going to report yourself. I'm going to do what? You're going to pick up the phone and call them and tell them that you have a drug problem and that you're going to treatment for 90 days. And then when you come back, they'll deal with you. And it, you know, at that point, I just didn't give a damn about anything. I just didn't want to feel the way I felt anymore. I felt like such a piece of shit. And it had compounded my whole life, all the things that I had done. Stuff with my family, just on and on. You know how we feel when we walk in through here. We all may have different stories, but when you come through that door, our pain is the same. We just don't want to live like this anymore. And they sent me off to treatment, and I learned a lot of good stuff, and I was introduced to the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous from H&I, who brought a meeting into that place. And they also took us out to meetings every night. We had to go every night. They figured that would be a good idea. But to let you know how unwilling I really was still, I wouldn't pick up a white key tag. I didn't pick up a white key tag until, like, almost 2 months in. And I was still like, yeah, I don't know about this shit. Well, I got done there and came back to Central Maryland. I had caught a meeting in Williamsburg, Virginia, where I went to treatment at, before I left. And I came home, and within half an hour, my wife was driving me out of my damn mind. And, of course, I had been on the phone with my girlfriend the whole way home. You know, still absolutely unmanageable, still having to touch that all the time, picking that up still, because I didn't know any better. No, bullshit, I knew better. I just couldn't stop. I looked at a meeting list that I had downloaded off the internet, and there was a meeting like 2 miles from my house. It's called Serenity on Sandy Springs. Meets Tuesday nights, 7:30. And when I had left treatment, there were some folks down there that had said, you know, you might want to be careful around NA. Sometimes it stands for not applicable. They don't really work a lot of steps in that fellowship, and there's not a lot of clean time. I was impressionable, but like that was the meeting list I had. I walked into a meeting. I was scared to death, absolutely scared to death to walk down into that basement with those people. Those people. I'm one of those people. But, and I watched a guy celebrate 16 years clean. This is his anniversary. So much for no clean time in Narcotics Anonymous. He now has 24, going on 25 years clean. And he still comes to meetings. You know, it's been an unbelievable process since then. I would get to meetings, like, right after they started and try to run out at the end. And people in my area that I'm ever grateful for, like Lance, who's, I think, was sitting in the back, and Peter C., and Bob M., and, you know, all them guys would, like, step in front of me and go, "Where are you going? You want to go get some coffee? You want to go get food at Denny's?" That's sort of an oxymoron, but we'll let that pass. At about 9 months clean, because up until that point, I had been going on like, I'm just going to do what I need to do for the 3 years they say I have to do it. Then I'm going back to doing what I want to do because, God damn it, I hurt. I live in chronic pain, and I am entitled to relief. Entitled. I kept telling myself I was entitled. One day at about 9 months, a light bulb went off in my head, and I looked around, and I saw that there were really, absolutely, truly happy people around me in those meetings, and they were smiling, and it was real. It was real happiness. It was real joy. They had real friendships and relationships with each other. And it was something I had never had in my life, and I wanted it. And I still didn't believe this would work, but what the hell? Nothing else that I had ever done in my life did. Maybe it was time for me not to run the show. So, you know, some of the things they said were, first off, don't pick it up, you won't get high. And in our area, they say a lot, don't pick it up and you won't get it in you. So no matter what, you got to stay clean. This thing won't work without that. They said, get a sponsor. It's the backbone of this fellowship. You need somebody to help you and guide you. They said, work steps, because if you don't, you're going to be the same addict that walked through the door if you don't work steps and you don't change your life. They said, get a service position, reach out and help someone, help another addict. And they said, you better find a power greater than yourself. And it can be whatever you want as long as it ain't you. Now, I have my own opinions on some of that, so I'll keep that to myself. But my first sponsor, who I basically told I'm an atheist, I'm an agnostic, I'm whatever you want to call me, but I don't believe in it, said, that's okay. He said, just believe in the rooms. Believe in what you see around you. Believe in that magic that happens between the prayers when we come together and stay clean. So I held on to that for a while until, through working steps, through being here a little bit, through working with my sponsor, I did get a higher power of my own that I believe in and am very happy with, and I know that, like, takes care of this universe for all of us, at least me. You know, where am I at? And it started to work. I started to get some courage, some ability to look at myself. And, you know, I really don't know what kept me clean in the beginning. Maybe it was all the rules and regulations I had stuffed down my throat because of the contract I was on. For some reason, when I went back to work, they wouldn't let me give out narcotics anymore. Nah. They wouldn't let me work night shifts, so I couldn't do my dirt in the dark. Monday through Friday, no overtime. And, man, I was just like, my God, this shit will never end. And it ended 6 years ago. I mean, you know. If we keep walking through this process, and walking through the things that jump up sometimes and smack us in the head, you turn around at some point and it's behind you. And when you get through it, you have coping skills. You have the ability to do it again or to help someone else who's going through it. A year and 1 month on Memorial Day, my dog, who was my best friend in the world, the one that used to lick my face and say, "You better wake up," died in my arms. And it's probably the closest I've come to picking up. I just almost just said, "Fuck it." And the choice I had was get high or call my sponsor. And I called my sponsor, and he came, and he stayed with me. And he held me while I cried for almost a day and a half. In my second year of recovery, my sister died. It was sort of expected. She had multiple sclerosis. She had had it for a long time. It was actually a blessing. But it was still, it was one of those things, you know. You go around my family at a funeral, guess what? It's on. It's on. They kept telling me, "Come home. We won't drink around you." And that was okay if there wasn't something going on, but let something be going on. Look out. That's why I always give myself an escape route when I go home. Still, today. Park last in the driveway, park on the street, always give myself an out. My third year, my oldest brother, who, you know, if you looked at him from the outside, he had it all. Double-digit millionaire, retired when he was 54. He was 64 at the time of this incident. Beautiful house, four beautiful kids. It all had beautiful kids. Fell down the cellar stairs drunk and died of a traumatic brain injury. And I got that phone call from my sister-in-law at 5:30 in the morning asking me what the hell the emergency room physician was actually telling her. When he was saying there's no sphincter tone and his brain stem is being compressed. And it really hurt to have to tell her that meant he's dead, basically. And I was able to go to New Jersey and help walk my family through taking him off of life support. Without going into the drawer that was behind me that was unlocked. Because, you know, sometimes they leave those things unlocked. I left it alone. Didn't want it. Because another thing I had heard in the rooms from somebody else that was in the medical profession was, guess what? That shit doesn't belong to you. Leave it alone. Same thing is, don't pick it up. You won't get high. When that happened, I had to call my boss and tell her that I wasn't going to be at work that day. She knows I'm in recovery, and a lot of the, I changed jobs. And some of the people that I worked with were also in this process. Within 5 minutes of calling her, my phone rang from 695 and 95 all the way to exit 8 on the New Jersey Turnpike with people calling me, telling me, "You're going to be all right." This one friend of mine called me, and he said, "You know," he said, you're going to make it, boy. You're a champion." I'm like, "What the hell are you talking about now?" Because he's a little crazy. But he's been around here a long time. And he said, "Do you know the difference between a champion and someone that sits on the bench?" And I said, "Well, what?" He said, "Champions play hurt." He said, "You're going to be all right." I went to meetings up there and shared, bawled my eyes out. People came up to me that had never, ever seen me before and hugged me and told me that they loved me and that everything was going to be okay. Just don't pick it up. My fourth year in recovery, my father died. Again, not unexpected. But the blessings of this program, of sponsorship, of working steps, is that I had come to a place where I was okay with him. And this was a man that my first memory of him is of him terrorizing me. I got okay with that through the steps and a little bit of outside help. They tell us here, you know, if you need outside help, go get it. I did. And I still occasionally go get a checkup from the neck up just to make sure, you know, that I'm doing okay. I've buried various assorted aunts and uncles. I've buried friends here using, and I've buried friends here that died clean. And the people, they all mean so much to me. But the people that went through this and went out clean, my God, what a message that you don't have to pick it up. This friend of mine, his name was Mark Kay, a lot of people in here know him, was just a wonderful, wonderful, giving human being. Was on his way to somebody's anniversary, felt like he was having a heart attack, went to the hospital. They said, well, you're not having a heart attack, but something's not right. And a day and a half later, they told him he had stage 4 esophageal cancer, inoperable, and you have maybe 6 days or 6 weeks. Get your shit together because there's nothing we can do for you. When he left that hospital floor, he didn't go out and get high. He didn't go out and get drunk. He didn't go get a ride. He walked downstairs to a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. And he shared about how grateful he was that God had his back. Blew me away. Because that was one of my reservations. You know, shit, if I get cancer, hell, at least I can go out really, you know, really toasted. He took that away from me. Thank God. I hugged a girl at our home group one time, and I told her, I said, you know, you just don't have to live like this anymore. I don't want to bury you. But if we do, I'm going to put a white key tag on your chest. And 4 days later, they found her dead with a spike in her arm in a recovery house. And I miss her so much. And the t-shirt you're wearing, she helped design that. And I saw it in the shadow boxes the other day, and it just made me cry. Because I miss Gwen so much. This is an amazing process if you get out of the way and let God work in your life. Let the steps work in your life. Let sponsorship work in your life. Let service to others work in your life. Let the steps work in your life. You know, one other thing, just on the flip side of this, I don't, how much time do I have? I don't want to, okay. It says, if you don't pick it up, you won't get high. Like I said, in Central Maryland, a lot of times we say, if you don't pick it up, you won't get it in you. The same goes for our literature. If you don't pick it up and read it, you ain't going to get it in you.